Gordon Tackreel too.
Can you tell me who was in your team by name and what their background was, please?
Well, I'll tell you what I know about them. I just look at this. I know them, of course. I just to get the spelling right.
You've got a printed record here of them, yeah. You're in Team Giles.
Yes, okay. That's correct.
Can you tell me about them?
Captain Knox, who's the leader of the team, was an American by nationality. He was, in fact, originally an Englishman. He went to Cambridge, and he was very professional, very good at speaking languages. He spoke something like, I'm told, 17 languages. I say that because I don't speak any foreign language at all. And he spoke French as well as any Frenchman, so that was very useful. He was, as I said, a captain in the American Army, and a very intelligent man, a very good man, a very nice man. And we got on extremely well.
And he appears to have been Captain BMW Knox.
Yes.
According to this record.
That's correct, yes. Bernard, his first name was. I don't know what the MW were.
And the other person in the team?
Captain LaBelle is a Frenchman. Down there is Captain LaBelle. That was, of course, a pseudonym, or nom de guerre. They all changed their names when they joined up, in case their families were involved in any sort of retribution. William was Captain LaBelle. And he was a regular French officer. Had been in the Foreign Legion and was recruited by the firm from Morocco when they ran out of officers in the French army in England. So they went to Morocco and recruited officers from the French Foreign Legion and places like that in Morocco. And he was a Foreign Legion, very strict officer. Very French, wouldn't learn how to speak English at all, didn't particularly like the English, was only there to do a job and that was it, sort of thing. And as a Foreign Legion officer, he didn't really consider other ranks to be of any particular value to mind the beast. Don't know, that sort of attitude, they all have that.
You mean old
so
French?
We didn't.
You mean old French?
No, no. There were two or three, to the best of my knowledge, I had very little to do with them, but at least two or three Foreign Legion officers, and they all appeared to have that attitude to other ranks, which is not apparent with the British and Americans, and with the French officers who'd come across after Dunkirk, or French men who'd come across and had been commissioners' officers after Dunkirk, they had a more liberal attitude than the North African officers, shall I say. But as I say, I only met possibly four. I can't remember the names. And they all seemed to have that attitude that other ranks were there to do as they're told, and that was it. And this attitude, I might say, by Captain Bell, carried on throughout the whole of the period we were in France. He went there to do a particular job and went and did it extremely well. But as far as he was concerned, I was just a radio operator and he'd help prepare the messages and then they'd pass them on to me to be encoded and transmitted. And that was it as far as he was concerned. He didn't worry too much about me or anything like that.
And LaBelle was his real name?
No, his real name's in brackets. The pseudonym, LaBelle's the pseudonym. His real name's, I can't remember what it was.
Oh, his real name was Captain Grawl.
Yes, yes.
G-R-A-L-L. And you had code names? You had your own?
Yes, you can see them there. I was Tinkle.
Tickle?
Tickle, yeah.
Says Tickle here.
Yes, Tickle, it was Tickle, yes. Nobody ever used them. Nobody ever used the code names. I don't know why they had them, good answer.
And And Grohl was supposed to be Loire.
Yes.
And Captain Knox, Kentucky.
That's right, yes.
But they weren't used.
No. No point. There's nothing... there was no need to use code names at all. So, I suppose it satisfied somebody in an office somewhere that... it. So we met, and after we met and we agreed that we should go in together, then we trained together. We did any force marches, for instance. We did a 10-day scheme in Scotland where we lived off the country in haystacks and that sort of thing. We travelled as a team, so we get used to each other, so, and get used to our little foibles.
By now, how much did you know about what you were supposed to do?
We were then, let me think, after the parachute jumps, after our parachute jumps in February, we were given a briefing about what the job was going to be, not about where we were going or anything else, but what the job was going to be. And we worked on that principle from then onwards, that we would go in as a team to arm and train active service units of the resistance movement.
How did you feel when you heard that you were going to do that?
Oh, quite happy. I was quite happy. I was quite happy with that. It sounded very interesting.
You weren't apprehensive about going behind German lines?
No, not at all. Even though I can't speak French.
But I was thinking about if they caught you.
If you look in the back of that book, it shows the names of the people who got caught and when they died and where they died.
So what happened, what do you remember happening next?
Well, we trained, as I say, we trained as a team. And when time came, we went down to Thamesford and prepared to jump, and that was it. We went down, in fact, in June, about D-Day time. But we made one trip over, and they'd shown the wrong lights. Then we made a second trip over, and they didn't show a light at all. And it was the third trip over that finally managed to get out. So it wasn't. I didn't get there until the night of July the 8th. But we had been prepared to go in a month earlier than that.
How confident were you about jumping?
Oh, at that time I was easy enough. There was no problem there.
What kind of a plane was it?
Well, we did all our trainings on Whitleys, you know, very old Whitleys. We actually did the jumps in France from Halifax. From a Halifax, not in the plural, a Halifax. And all the jumps were all done from Halifax. The drops were mainly Halifaxes, but occasionally Liberators, cargo planes. I mean, because they get the Halifax rather than the Lancaster, because they could carry a heavier cargo, although they were slower.
Did you get to know the pilot?
No. No, we never met them.
And were there any problems at all in going across?
No, other than the fact that we made two abortive attempts, because they were showing the wrong lights. Once we landed... they were there all ready for us. Badly organised, but all ready for us. The Frenchmen. Well, we brought with us quite a lot of arms and containers, and they were, I mean, a container of rifles and what have you is very heavy, and they didn't have the sort of transport necessary to take the arms away, and they were there, still there, next morning in daylight. Loading these onto the one or two old trucks that they'd brought with them.
Did it shake your confidence in them?
No, not really, no. We expected it. What did disappoint me was the fact that we brought with us our rucksacks with personal kit, cigarettes and stuff like that, and they'd very carefully gone through all that and stolen all the cigarettes and stolen anything else that was worth stealing. So... for the whole of the period there, I had one shirt, which I washed out on sunny days.
How many had you taken?
Well, I had about three spare ones, two spare ones in my pack, rucksack and they'd pinch these. But that, I found that was something that happened with all the guerrilla forces. I think it was part of their training to pinch kit when they could. When we, later in my service, when we went to Burma and Malaya, they it did exactly the same thing there. So it was something we got used to.
This was the 8th of July?
The night of the 8th, 9th, yes.
Where did you drop?
Brest, just outside Brest, Châteauneuf de Foux, in Finistère.
How did you feel once you were on enemy-occupied soil?
No great difference. This radio operating business was, although it was, we were well-trained, but it was a little bit complicated. The officers had been forced to do a little bit of operator training. They hated it. So they were the gung-ho boys, I think, and they wanted to get out and blow things up and all the rest sit and train and organise this and organise that. And they didn't want to do decoding and operating. Plus the fact that it was essential that once I got on the air, that I transmitted as quickly as possible in order that any German direction finding with machinery had that much less chance of finding us. So their speed was about 6 or 7 words a minute. And had they been forced to transmit, if I'd been killed or something like that, they would have been forced to transmit until they were able to get another operator. They would be forced to transmit at 6s and 7s. And with some of the messages we transmitted were very, very long, and they would have been on the air for hours. So it was essential that they kept me alive. So the first thing they did was say, right, you get into that corner, and not, under no circumstances will you go on operations. This, I think, was pretty personal on their part. They didn't want to be operators. So they didn't allow me to go on any serious operations. I was allowed to take part in the organisation of them and things like that, but not to actually go out and start pulling the trigger and that sort of thing.
Did you want to go?
Well, I did. I did enough to satisfy my sense of revenge. I organised a month later, I organised a bombing of a chateau which contained U-boat officers, and which was very satisfactory.
Can you tell me about that?
Well, that's the Chateau. I'll have to look this up. I can't remember. Chateau Lea.
Don't worry about the name of the place.
No, that's best to tell you the name if I know it. Chateau Lea. L-E-A. I remember now. Lea. Chateau Lea, which is just outside of Châteauneuf, where the U-boat officers used to go with their girlfriends, French girlfriends, and have a long weekend or an hour after they'd done the trip. And we knew about it. And I got the map reference, transmitted it back to London, and they sent across 3 planes and bombed it when on a Sunday night or something like that. It was Saturday night or Sunday night when it was full of U-boat officers, and that satisfied my sense of revenge.
So you especially wanted to do it because there were U-boats?
Yes. We did 2, in fact. We did that one, and we did another chateau which had infantry officers in, but the other U-boat officer one gave me the greatest sense of satisfaction.
What exactly did you do in the planning of that?
Well, I went to the place and looked at it and worked out on a map, the actual map reference, sent back the map reference, coded, of course, to London. They sent across a message via the BBC that the place was going to be bombed. And on the night that it was bombed, I sat on a hill about 200 yards away from the chateau and operated a thing called a Rebecca. Do you know Rebecca and Eureka?
I've heard of them.
Rebecca and Eureka. Rebecca's in the plane and Eureka's on the ground. And it's a little radio set which just transmits by means of a rubber button a signal over a long distance to the plane and the receiver in the plane, and it enables the pilot of the plane to guide to come in on a beam and get to his target that much more easily, because it was one house in the middle of nowhere, of course, is probably a little difficult to find. But I sat there on my hill and operated this Eureka sort of thing, and that pleased me. And then, as I say, they came in and I watched it bomb the chateau, watched them bomb the chateau. And they, as I say, the same night, they also bombed another chateau a bit further away, and the officers were there watching that.
Did they hit the chateau?
Yes, both cases.
So do you think they inflicted casualties?
They did, definitely. Because the Mackie went in immediately afterwards and checked, and there were definitely casualties, a lot of casualties.
And it was not only the U-boat officers, but some French girlfriend?
French girlfriend, yeah.
Where did you usually stay?
In haystacks. Sleeping mainly at this stage. We used to get up about... We were being chased most of the time that we were in France. We were being chased by German infantrymen, gendarmerie, what they call them. We were chased most of the time, and their habit was they used to get up about dawn and set off in their trucks to a location that they thought we were and search the place. And they knew that we stayed in farmhouses, moved from farmhouse to farmhouse. So we announced to that, got up at dawn and marched away, did a forced march, 8 or 10 miles away in rough country, in the wooded country, and stayed there until late in the day. Then we moved to another farm and stayed there the night, and then the Germans would come along the next day and do the same sort of thing. If we'd left no signs of the group we were with, our bodyguard sort of thing, if they'd left no signs of occupation at the farm, then they got away with it. If they'd left any signs of occupation, the Germans used to shoot the occupants of the farm.
How close did the Germans come to capturing you?
Well, I've got reports here, and 20 minutes was the nearest, 2 miles or 3 kilometres. That was the nearest I think they got. That was on when they were chasing us. We did one reconnaissance, which I went on. After one forced march, we came to a village we had to go through. Again, I've got the name there somewhere. A village we had to go through, and the Frenchmen had become exhausted by the forced march, which started off with about 30, which are personal groups, or I think it stayed with us all the time. We ended up with 8, and they wouldn't go through this village because they were a bit scared. So and 3 of us, Captain Knox, Captain LeBell and myself, went through the village to check to see if there were any Germans there. There weren't, so we came back and picked up the Frenchmen and took them through. And then Germans arrived. We had a report that Germans arrived about 3/4 of an hour later. So we just got away with it there. And it was the same with, we had to cross a river, and there were a choice of about 5 bridges. And we just picked the nearest one and went across on that, and all the other 4 had been towed by sentries. And the one that we went chose to go across by pure luck wasn't being manned at that particular time, and we managed to get across without any hassle. But it was pure luck.
How did you like being chased like a fox around
the Oh, not too bad. I was pretty fit, and it didn't worry me. I could do a forced march. During training, we had to do forced marches all the time. I did, we did 9 miles in 72 minutes, that sort of thing. It was a sort of... So being chased by Germans, ordinary infantry Germans, no problem. I could run faster than them.
But were you frightened?
No.
Well, What did you think of the resistance group with which you were working?
I was never really, to be perfectly honest, I was never really happy with Frenchmen. There were two, as you know, it was the FFI and the FTP. The FFI stayed in towns and worked as individuals or as pairs and things, that sort of thing. In the whole of, the French population at the time was about 50 million, and the FFI consisted of 2,000. So you can see the strength of their convictions was not very strong. The FTP, who were called communists by de Gaulle, and he hated them, nevertheless had many more people actually fighting, but they in turn tended to be criminals. And again, they weren't particularly fit. So we armed them and trained them in the use of their arms, and they were quite happy and brave when it came to actual hand-to-hand fighting, shall I say. I mean, if they had to go out and ambush a convoy or something like that, they were quite happy to stand there and shoot it out with the Germans. But if they had to march to get there, then they had problems. They much preferred to jump on the back of a truck and drive off in the truck and dismount the other end, do the job, and then come back again by truck. So they weren't very fit. The morale wasn't very good either, to be honest. They'd been chased around an awful long time. The Germans had been chasing them before we got there, and they were very badly armed, so they could do nothing but run. Until we got there and armed them and trained them, they couldn't dig the hills into anything. When we got there, we armed them, trained them, and broke them into companies under a more intelligent, the most intelligent person of the group, sort of thing, and sent them off to do specific jobs, and they were quite happy with this.
How did their morale show?
Well, as I say, this particular occasion, when we did a forced march, we started off with about 30, ended up with about 8, and it wasn't just physical ineptitude, it was a case of the morale was low as well, and they kept peeling off and going to hide in farmhouses and things like that as individuals. So we ended up with about 8, and the 8 wouldn't go through, not because they were just physically exhausted, although they said they were. In fact, their morale was so low that they were scared. That's just an example. But again, as I say, when it came down to hand-to-hand fighting, they were quite happy. They were all right.
How much could you communicate with them?
I couldn't at all, really. They tried to teach me French. They themselves tried to teach me French, and I was very bad at picking up languages. And I didn't really want to. So in the end, they found a French-Canadian who was working with them, and he stayed with me. And if I needed to do any interpreting, he did the interpreting for me. And he stayed with me all the time. And there was a small subgroup. There was me, this French-Canadian, and Lieutenant Brown, who was RAF, who'd escaped. And we picked him up, and he stayed with me, and he did not a lot of, but he helped me with the encoding and ciphering, and the helped out with transmitting now and again, sort of thing.
Brown had escaped from a POW?
He escaped from Germans. I don't know whether he was in a POW camp. I think he escaped. He got picked up by French resistance when he was shot down, and he couldn't find a way out. They couldn't find a way out, so he just kept out of the way and just travelled around until we picked him up. And we kept him with us until early August. Then we passed him over to the Americans when they came up to us.
But did you form any personal relationships of friendship?
No, I got friendly with the officer, not the officer, the person commanding the initial group of Mackie that we dropped into was their leader, and he had a younger brother, and I got quite friendly with him, and he used to help me out with the radio site now and again. but he got killed. And after that, I didn't really form any personal friendships. I was friendly with the French Canadian who was with me, and I got quite friendly with Lieutenant Brown, but you know, not personal friendships so much, just friendly acquaintance, put it that way. But I had no personal relationships with the male side of the organisation. I struck up a personal relationship with a young lady who's lived in a chateau that we ended up at, Chateau Carignan, I think it was called. And she was the daughter of the housekeeper. But she was 17, 18. It was quite a friendly one. But that, nothing came of that, of course.
But were you able to speak to her?
Oh, well, we communicated by the means that are always open to... I was only 19 at the time, and she was 17, 18, so our means of communication were physical rather than verbal. And we taught each other the odd words, sort of thing. And we got on very well. Nothing. She was too strictly brought up to be any nonsense, shall I say. She was a nice girl. And, she wrote to me once when I was in India, but I wasn't able to write back, and that was it.
Were the resistance group that you were with taking many casualties?
Yes. I don't know exactly, because as I say, I was kept out of the action, but my officers knew. We had something like, in all, because we had five extra groups dropped into us, five Jebba groups dropped into us, and they had their own areas. And they organised their groups again, they organised drops themselves and that sort of thing. So we ended up with the whole six groups arming and training something like 4,000, 5,000 men. Well, when you get that number of men, then you're bound to get casualties. And there were quite a lot of casualties, although I don't know exactly how many.
Did the casualties suffer very much, or did they get medical attention?
They got no medical attention from the Germans, of course. Theirs was a short end. And but they had a medical system within themselves. If they were able to get to their own doctors, we had two doctors who lived in town who could treat casualties when they occurred. If they could be brought to them, then they were treated and sent back to recuperate back to their unit.
Did you see any of the casualties?
No.
What did the Germans do to them if they caught them?
Shot them. Mind you, having said that, when we took prisoners of war, not we, when I say we, not me, of course, but when the French took prisoners of war, they shot them. So there was no... it was six of one and a half dozen the other.
Did you see any of the Germans who were captured?
I saw one being interrogated, a German warrant officer being interrogated. He'd been caught on the way to the lavatory, picked up on the way to the lavatory. He was taken away, made to dig his own grave, and then shot.
See them do it?
The shooting, no. I was told about it.
What did you think of that?
I didn't like it, but there was no way we could keep prisoners. There's no, absolutely no method of keeping prisoners. We had no detention quarters of any sort. They would have had to travel around with us, and that would have been it. And they could have escaped any time and been a source of information for the German authorities. So